Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, buy now, pay later. Sounds too good to be true, of course, except for in this case, it is true. Sezzle is a payment installment solution that lets you do just that. But should you? Is that smart? Patrick Chan is the general manager of Sezzle's Canadian business, and he'll be here then. Knowing exactly how much you pay for investment fees doesn't have to be difficult, but sometimes it can be. David O'Leary is the founder of a company called Kind Wealth, and he'll be here to tell us about subscription-based fee-only advice and making the right choice when it comes to picking life insurance. PolicyMe says it can help make that decision a little bit easier. PolicyMe's co-founder and president, Laura McKay, will be here to tell us how her service works and what needs to be taken into consideration when choosing a life insurance plan. Plus, how certain personality traits can affect your spending when it comes to retirement savings. Sarah Acevedo joins us with her research, published recently by the American Psychological Association. And Cornell Schreiber will be here to tell us a bit about Build Wealth Canada. All that's ahead. Let's get started. Life insurance may not be something that every Canadian needs, but for those who do need it, it can be really complicated when you're trying to choose a plan that fits you and your family. PolicyMe is a company that's trying to make this complicated decision a little bit easier. Joining us now to tell us more about PolicyMe is co-founder and president, Laura McKay. Hello there.
Hey, nice having me today.
Thank you for coming. What is it? How would you describe what PolicyMe is?
Yeah, of course. So we are a platform with a mission to make it simpler and more affordable for Canadians to get life insurance online. So we use modern technology to help give kind of a recommendation on one, whether or not you even need life insurance, and if you do, what the right product is for you. So we call this a life insurance checkup. And once you're completed that, it takes about 5 minutes. It's all online.
I did it. It takes under five minutes, I would even say.
We help you compare quotes from the major Canadian carriers like Manulife or BMO. And then we actually help you facilitate the application online as well. So we're really making it a lot simpler, a lot faster to get life insurance.
Is this analogous to the credit card comparison websites? I mean, there's comparison websites in so many parts of the financial world in particular.
Yeah. So when I think of the comparison websites, the only downfall to the ones that exist today for life insurance is that once you get the quotes, your life insurance quotes, you're putting in a phone number, and that phone number is being sold for about $30 to a broker.
It's a lead generation tool.
Yeah, that you have no relationship with. When you actually compare through PolicyMe and apply with PolicyMe, we are your life insurance advisor. So we're the ones behind the scene that help you through the application process. And then we're also there when the policy is put in place, to help you make changes down the line, to continuously look back on whether the coverage still makes sense for you, whether you need to change it. So we are your life insurance advisor. We're just a digital advisor.
Is that analogous to broker or life insurance broker? Is it the same thing?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Advisor and broker.
So PolicyMe would be a competitor to the broker who you could have used the last time round or who your friends have recommended.
Exactly. But today in Canada, about 95 to 97% of policies are sold face-to-face. So we're a non-face-to-face option for you.
Right.
If you don't want to find a broker or you don't know one, you can come online and do a lot more self-serving, but we're there to help you along the way.
What would be the order of magnitude on cost difference? So face-to-face, someone had to drive to my house, so that costs some money. You don't have to drive to my house because we're doing it virtually. How much cheaper would a policy through you be versus the traditional way?
Yeah, so Canadian regulation today doesn't allow us to discount policies at all. It is illegal to discount policies. So no matter where you're buying that Manulife policy, it's the exact same price from any distributor, whether it be a broker down the street who's selling it to you face-to-face or through us. So the way our business model works is we get paid a commission on every sale. That commission is paid through Manulife so that the service is free to you. But that commission is totally standardized across the market.
So why wouldn't I just go for a face-to-face person? Why is it better to have a virtual experience?
Yeah, so a few reasons. One is we use, again, modern technology to help give very unbiased and honest advice. And we strongly believe in our advice. We think we're probably the only calculator online that actually turns away customers. We believe not everyone needs life insurance. So we strongly believe that we are giving more accurate and smart and personalized advice for you, because we spent so much time building up the algorithms that generate our recommendations on what product makes sense for you. We also have the benefit of working with many different insurers, so we're making sure to get you the best price in the market for
pre-entrepreneur. You were an actuary,
yes.
Which, as someone who I would say I did fine in math, but the idea of being an actuary makes me kind of want to cry a little bit. What is it that you bring from that world that you either wanted to continue to push for or to rail against in the design of this new business? What really did you feel like the value add would be? Because you've seen lots of different models. You've played around with the actuarial, the mortality tables and all that.
Yeah, so we strongly understand, one, kind of what the purpose of life insurance is. That's what I studied in school. And two, how these products are priced. And we definitely use that knowledge to give you a very honest recommendation on what you need. So we help do all the math behind the scenes to project out, you know, what kind of need your family is going to need down the line, whether it be in 10 years or 20 years. And then we use that information to recommend the right policy.
What are the key variables? Now, I have some sense of it because I did your online, answered all your online questions. Give us the top three variables that determine how much coverage you should sign up for. Because you don't want to have too little, but you also don't want to be paying vast amounts of money for it to have too much.
Yeah. So definitely one of the biggest ones that contributes to the recommendation is any debt that you have. Obviously, if you have a mortgage, you would definitely likely need a bigger life insurance policy than someone who doesn't need it.
Do you mean that they've paid it off or because they rent?
Because they have a large debt that would be passed on to their family if anything were to happen to them. So a mortgage that is outstanding.
Right. But someone who rents would have a monthly expense that their surviving spouse and their children would need to pay. So wouldn't that need to be factored into the payout?
We help factor that in as well. So what we do online is we kind of take some questions from you around your household type. Whether you have kids, whether you have a spouse, as well as your financial situation around kind of what your monthly expenses are, and make sure that your family is able to pay those monthly expenses, maintain their lifestyle if anything were to happen to you. So it would include, you know, paying off those mortgage payments, but also paying off those rent payments if you do rent.
There are many people out there who say, I don't know, I got some sort of life insurance with work. I don't even know what it is. And they feel like they're covered, and they may well be. But they also may well not be. What would you have them do after listening to this conversation to check and see if what they've got from their employer is sufficient?
Yeah, well, I'm biased, so I would say go on policyme.com and take our advice.
But you're going to ask them for some questions that I assume they'll need to research.
Yeah, so we actually ask you how much do you have through work, because you should definitely take that into account when you're looking at kind of your full life insurance needs picture. And we don't double count. So if you get $100,000 through work today, we say, let's take that off your total needs and we'll recommend the difference. And so I would definitely say, look at what you have, understand what your benefit package is, take account of kind of what you need and subtract what you have. And then that's what your gap is. And that would be what you would ask for an individual policy.
One of the things that surprised me going through your site was how inexpensive it is for a term policy. It's not that expensive. So how does your model play with the slider of $500,000 in payout versus $800,000, which would be material to a family who was receiving that payout? Not so material in terms of the monthly carry. Like, I don't know if that's a $50 difference per month or what it is.
Yeah. So it definitely depends on your age. You can see life insurance is very, very affordable for someone who's in their 30s and 40s because it tends to be around, you know, I would say about $30 a month for $500,000 of coverage. So we recommend kind of what policy size makes sense for your family. But as you said, we also give you the option to scroll up or down. Some people are pretty conservative and say, you know what, I don't want, even though you accounted for my spouse making a future income after I pass away, I don't really want my spouse to have to work again.
Right.
And so I would actually increase that amount by quite a bit. And we allow you the flexibility to do that.
Your questionnaire did not ask me if I completed the New York City Marathon 2 weeks ago, which of course I did.
That's wonderful.
Why isn't there more about one's current health?
Yeah. So we are working that into the picture. Right now, when you're quoted on a life insurance policy, insurers use three different attributes to give you your quote. It's your age, your gender, and your smoking status. But as you kind of alluded to, that's not enough to give you a final price. What happens after you get your quote is a quick medical interview with your insurance company. It takes about 20
minutes. Like burpees? Are there burpees and jumping jacks? Is that...
No, it's a phone call with a healthcare professional where they'll go through a number of questions related to your lifestyle and your health. So if you are an amateur pilot and you're flying on the weekend every weekend, maybe you're a little bit riskier than the average person to insure,
right,
and you could see your price go up because of that. Similarly, if you've recently been diagnosed with a health condition, which would make you a little bit more riskier, you could see your price go up after that. And so right now, the way the quoting, pretty much every quoting engine works is they don't take that into account because they think it's fairly complicated to bring that into the early quoting algorithms.
Right.
But we're looking to build that out. So we're trying to collect the information based on our clients who have gone through the full application process, and we see how prices have changed based on certain health attributes, we're going to actually bring in that transparency up front. So you have a better sense going in.
I just work my marathon into any conversation. I just work it in. It's like, so how was your weekend?
Yeah.
Laura, that's the time that we have. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks.
Laura McKay, co-founder and president of Policy Me. Stay with us. Coming up next, Kind Wealth's David O'Leary is here to tell us about subscription-based, fee-only financial advice. That is a mouthful. Later, we're going to talk to Cornell Schreiber. He is the founder of Build Wealth Canada, about how his site can help you get a handle on your finances. And hey, if you ever have been concerned about missing an episode of Moolala, do not worry. You can go to moolala.ca. There is an opportunity to listen to segments or full podcasts. You can also do that on any of the podcast platforms. While you're there, write us a review. Subscribe to the next episode so it'll arrive straight to your device. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Do you know exactly how much you pay in investment fees? If the answer is no, you're in good company. Most people don't have a clue, which is not good, considering that fees can be one of the largest expenses you incur in a year, especially if you're, you know, a senior, maybe you're in retirement, you're just starting to draw down your assets. It can be a huge amount of money. Now, that is one big difference between fee-based and fee-only financial advice. David O'Leary is the founder of Kind Wealth, which offers a subscription-based fee-only financial service. David is here now to tell us more about the costs of financial advice and how things work at Kind Wealth. Hello there.
Hey, thanks for having
me. I'm now super conscious about being nice because the name of your company is Kind.
Right.
What if you were like a real jerk to like an associate in a retail store? Is that off brand for you?
Honestly, I think about it a lot. Like even, you know, when I'm
driving, it's
a forcing mechanism for me to be nice because I can't run a company.
You should have called your company Aggressive Wealth. And then you'd have free reign.
Right.
Free reign.
It's good. It's a forcing mechanism.
It's true.
Make me a better person.
So the reason I wanted to talk to you about this, I've talked for a decade about the way financial advisors are compensated. Three basic models: commission-based, fee-based, fee-only. Yours is not one I have seen, and that is subscription-based, fee-only. How does this work?
Yeah, so it is a subset. I think you've classified that exactly right. It's a subset of fee only. So meaning our clients pay us a flat dollar amount for the advice they're receiving from us. We receive no other compensation of any sort, so that the client just knows that we have no skin, you know, we have no vested interest in anything other than giving them good advice. And it works instead of typical fee only would be you pay one lump sum for a defined deliverable.
Yep. It's like having an accountant file your taxes.
Yeah.
So you give pay a financial advisor $3,000 and they give you a financial plan.
Exactly. And what we do is we say, instead of that, we're going to charge a smaller amount up front and then a monthly subscription. For as long as you want to continue to work with us, you continue to pay that.
And how does the investing piece work in? Because with fee only, traditionally, it's you pay the fee, you get the advice, but they don't even necessarily recommend investment products.
That's
so
right.
You DIY it, you go on a discount brokerage account or whatever.
Right.
How does it work in your world? Is there support on the portfolio construction?
So we work very similarly. We are not licensed. We don't manage investments for our clients or give individual investment advice. We do sit on, in our case, the Wealthsimple platform, so that clients who, if they want to use a robo-advisor, can set up their accounts and have that all managed for them. We do not collect any fees, so we have no interest. If you want to work with a robo-advisor, a Nestwealth, a Wealthsimple, great.
You don't care.
We don't care.
You're agnostic, I should
100%.
Say. 100%. You care because you're
kind. Yeah, we want to make sure that they get
care.
The right service, but we're agnostic.
The tagline on your website is, money doesn't have to be so mean.
Mm-hmm.
You talk a lot about social enterprise. Are you a social enterprise? Are you a B Corp or are you a for-profit with a conscience?
We are an aspiring B Corp. We're very early in the process, so we're a bootstrapping startup right now. I've been in through the process and spoke with the folks at B Labs about the B Corp certification. We will be a B Corp.
For our listeners, give the basic definition for what that means.
Yeah, so it stands short for a benefit corporation. In the U.S., this is an actual legal structure. In Canada, it's not. It's a certification you can get that basically says you are treating people and the planet very well in the process of conducting your business and that you're operating it for the benefit of society. And so that would cover things like, how do you treat your staff and how do you are you compensating them fairly? What are the sort of parental leave policies, things like that?
Yeah.
Or supportive, nurturing environment. And what is your environmental footprint and are you cognizant of those things? What's your governance structure?
Right.
Yeah.
I want to come back to the notion of fees. And we're going to use a kind of an example of someone with $1 million in assets under management.
Mm-hmm.
If they're in a commission-based world and they pay a 2% MER, it's $20,000 a year.
Yeah.
If they're in a fee-based world and pay 1% a year, it's $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
At Kindwealth, if they're in your subscription, and I know you've got different levels,
yeah.
What's that dollar amount apples to apples? Apples to apples to apples, because I had three. There's three there, so there's three apples.
Yeah, so to give you an idea, ours is based on the complexity of the client situation. So we give a price range on our, and I'll get to exact dollar amounts, on our website. So the range, for instance, that we've charged a client has been anywhere from $1,000 up front to $3,000 at the high end.
Mm-hmm.
And the ongoing is anywhere from 150 to 350. That's the range of the clients that we've
yep.
worked with. Most of our clients skew younger, but we do have some older clients as well. So if you kind of do that math and you say $3,000 up front and I'm going to just keep it simple for now. So let's call it $300 a month. So $3,600 plus the $3,000, you're talking about $6,600.
Right.
On $1 million portfolio, you've just done we see what those comparisons
yeah.
look like. So the irony here is most of our clients are younger because they're not getting service. They're not getting good financial planning anywhere
yeah.
else. They don't have big enough portfolios. But it's actually a better deal for those with bigger portfolios
right.
because of the percentage of assets.
You have a four-stage process. What are those four stages?
Yeah, so that's evolved a little bit from the website. I mean, the four stages are still the same. I mean, you've got an onboarding process where we get to know, collect all your information. What are your goals and all that? We'll then kind of go back and do some analysis and planning and put together recommendations, get together, meet with people, deliver those recommendations. And then the fourth is kind of this ongoing iterative back and forth. What's happened though is what's really interesting is the subscription model, where the client's paying every single month
mm-hmm.
an amount, has forced us to actually change how we deliver the advice. So instead of having that second stage where we deliver all of the advice and recommendations in one big meeting where we're throwing all this information at you
mm.
and you'd absorb maybe 15-20% of it.
But I would smile knowingly.
Yeah.
And I'd be very – I'd look like I was super engaged
100%.
And was going to do everything you recommended.
Exactly. what we do now is say the client's going to wonder if we just deliver this all and then don't see them again for 12 to 18 months,
right.
Why are they continuing to pay a monthly fee? So what we do is we break the engagements into smaller chunks and we'll deal with just one issue at a meeting and spread that out over time so that they're absorbing more of it. And we don't leave the first meeting until we've got the next meeting booked. So when we come back in 2 months from now, I'm going to ask you, did you do X, Y, and Z?
Right.
So that at the end of the time, they've got an accountability partner as well.
One of the big challenges in the Canadian marketplace is that there are very, very few providers of fee-only
That's
advice.
Right.
People ask me about this all the time. It's very hard to get a referral. There's not a lot of people doing that. Why is that in your view? I have an opinion. Why is that in your view? And what's it going to take to grow the category so people are aware of that as an option?
Yeah. The financial reward to charging a percentage of assets, whether that's a commission or fee-based, both function off of that percentage
of higher.
Assets, right? It's way higher. It's easier. It's out of sight, out of mind. You never, like I say this in, when I'm talking to people, it is crazy that you you never receive an invoice for the fees you're paying. You're paying $10,000, $20,000 a year,
yeah.
And you don't get an invoice to tell you what you paid? That's
yep.
crazy.
Yep.
And so the reason they do that is because it's out of sight, out of mind. It's siphoned quietly from your investment accounts so that you're not aware of what you're paying. And most people are not aware. So it's easier. You're getting paid more. You can take more and do it easier, less resistance. I think the tide is changing, though. People are more aware and starting to ask more questions, especially as we push down into the younger demographics, which I think culturally have a more distrust of big, large, established. They're more anti-establishment.
Yep.
And so they'll ask those questions more. I think what it'll get to change, as sad as it sounds, you know, the average advisor in Canada is, you know, in their late 50s, early 60s. It's just going to take a big whack of them to retire. I don't think they're going to change the way they go about pricing their services in the last 5 years
yeah,
of their
Yeah, certainly, and if it's
careers.
Profitable. It'll also be as this young cohort comes into money and
yeah.
they have been at a lower cost platform when they had no money,
yeah.
and now they have big money and don't want to trade up to a higher cost model.
Yeah, you know, so this is a really interesting phenomenon. We have increasing transparency, right? There's, for the first time ever, the dollar amounts that you're paying on statements through this
yep. CRM2
mm-hmm. is making it more visible. It's not perfect. And at the same time, you've got this massive intergenerational transfer of wealth. So what you'll have is younger clients who are more informed, know more what they're paying, and then they're going to have this moment where they get this big inheritance. And overnight, the amount that they're going to pay their advisor is going to radically jump, and they're going to know it.
If they stay in place.
Yeah, if they stay at that percentage of assets. I think that's going to put a lot of pressure on that percentage of assets model.
Interesting. David, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
David O'Leary, the founder of Kind Wealth. What caught my attention was their subscription-based fee-only financial planning model. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, we're going to talk to Sarah Azbido about her latest study on how certain personality traits can affect how you spend your retirement savings. Then later in the program, we'll take Laura McKay, co-founder and president of Policy Me, through our How I Do It questions. I've got a newsletter that brings together a whole bunch of stuff that I do on this show and on other shows. If you want to sign up for that newsletter, it is at moolala.ca, and it's once a month. You'll hear about Prosper, the Financial Advisors podcast, my columns on CBC Radio and CityLine, in addition to what you hear here on Moolala Money Made Simple. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Your personality can affect really almost every aspect of your life, your relationships, your work, your parenting style, and it turns out, your retirement savings. There are hundreds of so-called studies about this, and many of them are headline grabbers, but there's this new one that I wanted to talk about, in part because it's backed by academic research and published by the American Psychological Association. It explores how personality and psychological characteristics can affect your portfolio, in particular, how you withdraw those savings in retirement. The lead author of the study is Sarah Azbido. She is a certified financial planner, and she joins us from Lubbock, Texas. Hello there.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
As I mentioned, there's a lot of studies out there. They can be low base. There's no rigor on the research. They're clearly, you know, trying to sell us something as a marketing message. How did you go about designing this study?
Well, what we did, my co-author and I, Dr. Chris Browning, we took a look at the research and noticed that there is a lot of research, as you noticed, or at least analysis around how much people can withdraw in retirement without running the risk of depleting their retirement savings accounts too early. But what we noticed is that there was really a lot of information about technical, economic things that can affect how much you can withdraw, but there was really little out there that talked about or looked at in a rigorous way how human behavior affects retirement portfolio withdrawal decisions. So we decided to understand that further and dig into the human side of decision making when people are taking money out of their retirement portfolios.
And let's talk about some of the things that you learned. There's something called the 3M model of motivation and personality. What should we know about that?
Well, that's a model that was put together by John C. Moen. And the 3M model basically gives us a framework to understand how to explore this research question. It tells us that psychological characteristics, starting with personality, can combine to explain why people behave the way they do. So we use this model to look at a base level of traits called the Big Five personality: openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. Then we looked at how those traits affect people's expression of positive emotions and negative emotions. Then the next layer is something that is specific to finances. We looked at the sense of control and resiliency people have over their financial situation. So we looked at combinations of traits to determine, well, how do these combine to affect how people decide to take money out of their portfolios?
I am an off-the-charts extrovert. Like, I would probably break the extroversion calculator if you submitted my personality into it. What findings do you have about how these personality traits connect to the withdrawal rates on retirement savings?
Well, things look good for you. So extroversion is a trait that in the sort of wealth accumulation, like building wealth literature, it shows that extroverts accumulate higher levels of net worth. They tend to engage in higher earning income occupations, and they tend to accumulate money. Now, from a spending perspective, extroverts tend to be a little bit looser with their money, so they may not exhibit really prudent money management behavior all the time, but nonetheless, they still manage to accumulate and grow wealth, and they also tend to experience more positive emotions. What we found in this study is that extroverts, when they transition to the withdrawal phase, they withdraw at a lower rate than someone who is less extroverted. So there's some saving ability or saving mentality that an extrovert has, similar to the conscientiousness trait. Conscientious people tend to follow through with their financial goals. They tend to be really good savers. They tend to watch their money, and that relates to higher levels of the sense of control and resiliency, which we call self-efficacy in the study, and then that also translates into lower withdrawal rates. So from the study, we can say that when we look at the Big Five, those who are highly conscientious, highly extroverted, tend to withdraw less, have a lower portfolio withdrawal rate in retirement. The other traits, so those who are higher in openness, if you are highly agreeable, if you're highly neurotic, those traits have a relationship with less positive emotion, more negative emotion, less control and resiliency, and higher portfolio withdrawal rates. So you can, the story there is openness, agreeableness, and neuroticism. If those are more dominant traits that you have, you could be more at risk of running out of money in retirement, but there is also a caveat here in that high and low withdrawal rates doesn't necessarily mean, you know, high is bad, low is good. It all depends on if you're on a path to deplete your money too early. Because if you do have a higher withdrawal rate, but it's at a rate that's considered safe and not at risk, then you're probably doing a really good job of maximizing your lifestyle in retirement. It's when that rate gets too high, you might have a hard time reining it in if you needed to.
What do you think people should take away from this study, aside or in addition to the fact that my personality traits are amazing and I got it made in the shade? I'm kidding. What should people take away from this research?
Well, I think one is recognizing, like, for you, you may be highly extroverted, but also what's your conscientiousness? How agreeable are you? How much enduring stress and worry do you feel? So people aren't just one of these traits. They're a combination of them. And I think people can learn from this study by gaining insight into who they are, their tendencies for natural behavior, like personality traits tend to describe how people naturally think, feel, and behave. So if I'm highly agreeable, which I am, I'm probably more likely to have trouble telling someone, no, I can't do that. Or when it comes to finances, you might have a harder time telling a friend or a family member or a child or even a beloved charitable organization that you cannot gift any more money. So if you are highly agreeable, you can look at that trait and understand how might this natural tendency for behavior and feeling interfere with my portfolio withdrawal decisions. How is it helping me? How is it hurting me? So it may feel really good to give, and that's a great thing to do and great thing to develop relationships. However, if you have a high withdrawal rate and you're having trouble slowing that down or telling someone, no, I can't give anymore or it's not in my best interest to, then you can learn how to maybe combat those natural reactions.
One last question before we go in terms of the analysis here. How did you factor out or account for circumstantial things like marital status or mortgage debt or all the other things that would, in very practical terms, affect people's withdrawal rates?
Yes, and very simply, we put them in the model. So we included things like age, work, couple status, gender, education, race, homeowner status, debt, life expectancy assumptions, expectations to leave an inheritance, perceptions of health. And we included all those things to first model, do these things affect withdrawal rates? We know from the technical and economic literature that they do. We wanted to see, okay, above and beyond this, do personality traits and sort of human behavioral factors, do they affect withdrawal rates above and beyond these other things that we know have already been shown to? And what we found is that they did. They still had a relationship with withdrawal rates, even though we included these other things in the model.
Really interesting stuff. Sarah, thank you for joining us to talk about the study.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sarah Acevedo joined us from Lubbock, Texas. The focus of her research was on the connection between personality and how we manage our retirement savings.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Buy now, pay later. It's a pretty compelling proposition for consumers, many of whom have budgets that are already pretty stretched. Well, that's the idea behind an installment payment company called Sezzle. Patrick Chan is the newly appointed general manager of Sezzle's Canadian business, and he's here now to tell us about how Sezzle works. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce. Thanks so much for having me.
So what's the deal? How does this work?
So Sezzle represents a smarter and simpler alternative to traditional forms of credit. The concept itself is pretty simple. It's an alternate payment method that allows shoppers to budget their payments over time. They split their e-commerce purchases into four interest-free installments over 6 weeks. For the listeners who might know what layaway is, it's really similar to that, except you get the item right away, and then you pay for it over 6 weeks.
Well, I think that makes it quite different in that layaway was you buy the thing, but you don't get it
exactly until
you've paid.
Yeah.
Whereas here, you get the thing, and then you pay for it afterwards.
Exactly. So a lot of times you might hear about it referred to as reverse layaway.
Right.
Yeah. So shoppers first see Sezzle typically on a participating merchant site. So this is a retailer.
They go to buy something, and it's either insert your credit or pay with credit card or pay with Sezzle.
Exactly. But they will, on the product page, when they're shopping on a website, they'll see typically near the price that the product they're looking at could be paid in four installments with no interest, no impact to their credit score, and an instant approval or decision.
Capital is cheap these days, but it isn't free. So no. Who pays the cost of the loan?
That's a great question. So how do we make money? So Sezzle flips the traditional point-of-sale financing model on its head. I mean, we charge the merchant a processing fee, which is typically slightly higher than their average credit card.
Interchange fees. So say exactly. That's 3%. Yeah. You're what? Are you 10% or 8%?
No, we're anywhere between 4.5 to 6, depending on the volume, okay.
So they take a margin hit.
They would take a margin hit. And in return, we are proven, and we have got a ton of stats to demonstrate that we deliver material impact to things like online conversion, to their average basket size. And on top of that, Sezzle, we're responsible for all fraud checks using our proprietary risk based on our tech. And any non-payment, chargeback, or fraud risk is on us.
Now, one of the things that I can see being compelling for a buyer, but an interesting one from a business model standpoint, is that you don't conduct a credit check.
It's a soft credit check.
It's a what? It's a soft credit check. Okay, so you could decline someone based on that soft credit check?
Correct.
Ah, I see. Now, tell us more about the kind of buyer that Sezzle attracts. Is it someone who's already got a big balance on a credit card who can't afford to put anything else there? Is it someone who's underbanked and maybe doesn't have a credit card? What's the demographic?
Sure. So I'll start with what motivated our founders to found this company in the U.S. So 30% of millennials in the U.S. don't own a single credit card. And in a recent survey, millennials actually said they fear credit card more than death itself, which is a crazy, crazy stat. In Canada, the landscape isn't quite the same. Many millennials and Gen Zers do have credit cards, which have absolutely amazing benefits, but only when used in a responsible way. Mm. But even still, 87% of young consumers said they want a more simple way to pay over time. That's not a credit card. I think, you know, some of the stats we've seen recently are that Canadians carry an average of $23,000 each in debt. Equifax has data that shows there's a decline of people who completely pay off their credit cards each month, which is sitting at around like 56% now. And TransUnion reported that recently millennial debt was up 12.3% compared to a year ago. So
it's all worrying.
It is very worrying. So by offering our buy now, pay later solution, what we do is we provide customers with another option. So that doesn't affect their credit score. So for younger consumers, particularly Gen Z or millennials, or immigrant families like the one that I grew up in with little or no credit history, Sezzle is a great alternative to traditional credit. Another reason why shoppers love Sezzle is our checkout experience. Mm.
I'm just gonna jump in here. It says on your website that Sezzle is fully aligned with your financial interests.
Yep.
How do you mean that? Because I read it. I mean, it's not allowing them to pay for a roof over their head. It's allowing them to shop an Italian sportswear brand.
So we like to say that we help people get what they need, not so much what they want.
But it's not groceries. They're not putting groceries on this or rent.
Definitely not rent, but maybe groceries in the future. We don't currently work with any grocery companies, but you would be surprised to hear that our average basket size in Canada is about $130. So we're not talking about large purchases like furniture.
You also reference for you the phrase is people don't have to endure burdensome credit checks. What's so burdensome about a credit check? It's never bothered me.
It bothers some people, and it takes a long time to fill out those forms. It's sometimes pretty hard to get a credit card.
I don't know. I just strike that from your press release next time. What happens if someone doesn't pay? Do you send the loan to collections like any other loan?
No, we don't. So Bruce, our mission and vision at Sezzle is to empower the next generation financially. We believe in and promote financial responsibility. Again, we view Sezzle as a lightweight entry point to credit for young consumers. And we want
Does it help
to
build them score? Does it help them build their score?
Not currently, but we are building a financial services company around financial responsibility. Mm. So it's potentially something we could look into in the future.
Payday loans are something that are regulated provincially in Canada. Who regulates installment payments? What are some of the specific regulatory things that you have to keep in mind? I know the dynamic is different in Canada and the U.S.
Right. So our CEO, Charlie, just recently met with the CFPB in the U.S. In Canada, I believe we have talked to regulators in the past, but because I've only been doing this for 3 weeks, I'm not sure yet.
Yeah, because one of the things on the U.S. side of the business is that it's almost like they're flying, and you're not the only company. There's other installment payment plans like Afterpay.
Of course.
They're flying under the radar of the regulatory world, mm-hmm. so they're not popping up into the crosshairs of regulations.
Right. I it hasn't come up for me yet.
I guess my overall question is it seems to enable people to spend more than they have. One of the data points is very compelling to a seller is increasing the basket size by 50%. That is not compelling for the mm-hmm. financial health of a buyer. It actually terrifies me. So I look at your model and I think, it doesn't sound like financial sustainability to me. It sounds like we're trying to get people to spend more and provide a way for them to borrow more when maybe they should really just not be shopping.
Right. And I hear that our stats prove a little bit otherwise because we have I can't give the exact stat because we're publicly traded, but our loss rates are very low. So we do get paid back most of the time. And we like to think of our decisioning model is actually based on approving what we call prime to be customers. And even those that might have been overlooked by traditional lenders, we do everything in our power to make it free for the customer. And the only time they would ever pay more than the purchase price is if they want to reschedule an installment plan, and we give the first one for free. And even then, our missed payment fee is $10, which really is just a nominal amount to make sure that there is incentive to pay on time.
Very interesting stuff. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it. Patrick Chan is going to be running the Sezzle business here in Canada. They've got these new installment payment plans. Much more for us to learn on that front. Stay with us. Coming up next, Cornell Schreiber will be here to talk about Build Wealth Canada. It is a website that helps you get a handle on your finances with a bunch of resources, including a podcast. Then later, Policy Me's Laura McKay is going to take us through how she handles her very own personal finances. If you're looking for some books to help you get a handle on your money, I've written a couple, including Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things with Their Money and What You Can Do About It. Available at all online store. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The world of investing can be complicated. Not everyone is super duper savvy in this department. Cornell Schreiber created a whole bunch of resources to make things a little bit easier. It's called Build Wealth Canada, a website that aims to help you get a handle on your finances with, there's free guides, there's a podcast, an online course, a whole bunch of stuff. So we have chosen it as a blog to watch, even though blogs, probably like a 2008 term. Cornell joins us now to tell us more. Hello.
Hi, Bruce.
Did you call it a blog back in the day? Now, what do you call it? A platform?
I still call it a blog, but it's a podcast.
It's more than that.
Much a podcast, exactly.
So how would you describe what your mission is with Build Wealth Canada? What are you trying to do?
Sure. So I found that when it comes to personal finance in Canada and investing, I mean, there's so much great content out there, but so much of it is created by the U.S. They have the population, they have a much bigger industry than we do. And so we as Canadians, we read and watch these great tips and tricks and things like that. And we want to act on them, but we wonder, well, hold on, does this apply to me as a Canadian? We obviously have a different tax system here. We have different investment options. And so with Build Wealth Canada, what I do is I interview the top experts like yourself on the show to really learn the best practices when it comes to investing and personal finance, and to make it specifically for Canadians to know, so we can actually apply this ourselves.
You claim on your website that yours is the top personal finance podcast in Canada. Really? Really? I want proof. I want a lawyer's letter. I want Nielsen data on that. I'm just kidding. Clearly you have a lot of fans and a lot of people. What are some of the interviews, aside from the one that we did ages ago, what are some of the voices that you think that you've interviewed on your podcast that you think we need to listen to mm-hmm. that are really relevant and resonant in the conversation today?
Sure. So I know you're involved with MoneySense quite a bit. So yeah. We definitely have some, I guess, from there. Julie Kazin was one of the earlier guests, just like yourself.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed her interview. This was a while back. You'd have to go a little back into the archives. Recently, I interviewed Jason Heath as well. So we did a lot of things about
fee-only financial
fee-only financial planning, optimizing things that way. And then the FIRE movement, the financial independence, retire early movement has really picked up steam here in Canada. I had Bryson Christie on the show recently as well, talking about their experience. That was really fun. It's kind of inspirational, I think, for a lot of people that are in a job they don't like and want to get
out. Tell us about your transition from a corporate job to small family business and how that led to you starting Build Wealth Canada.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely was quite the journey. I mean, it was a $20,000 pay cut to go from a nice, high paying corporate job to sort of a small family business. And then, there's not a lot of, no benefits, no RSP matching. So it was, but I learned being in a high paying corporate job that money isn't everything. There's other things that, for sort of self-actualization and fulfillment and all that. And so, so we did make some sacrifices in that way. But at the end of the day, it was, I feel it was the right decision. We still ended up okay. And the markets have been doing quite well, so we can't complain.
You were able to pay off your mortgage at what, 29?
Yes.
How did you do that? Yeah.
So we essentially decided when we took on the mortgage, we decided that we were only going to live off one of our salaries. Mm. And so one of our salaries was just purely for day-to-day type expenses. And the other one was purely dedicated towards paying off the mortgage. I wouldn't necessarily have done things that, going back now, looking back, I would have invested a lot of that instead of just focusing on paying down the mortgage.
You still would have been that focused and that rigorous. You might have just allocated the dollars differently.
For sure, 100%. 100%. Yeah. Knowing what I know now, I would have actually spent a lot more of that investing.
And is that because the guaranteed return of mortgage elimination is lower than the return that you can earn in the stock market?
Exactly. That's pretty much it. At the time, when we took on our first mortgage, this was like 2007, 2008. So, I'm fresh out of school.
Yeah.
The crash happens.
People were panicked.
We get terrified. The smart thing to do would have been, let's plow all that money into the markets while they're low. However, we're fresh out of school. We don't know. So we got scared. We just said, let's just pump our money into the mortgage because that's a save. That's a guaranteed thing. Knowing what I know now, interviewing, dozens and dozens of personal finance experts across Canada, I know that that's not necessarily the most efficient thing to do in terms of money. I should have invested a lot.
What was the very first, if you think back, what was the very first spark for you that you thought, oh, this is interesting. I like this. I want to learn more about this for I'm sure first for yourself before you thought about doing the podcast or the video series or whatever. What was that first spark?
In terms of investing or paying off the mortgage?
Being curious about personal finance. Mm-hmm.
I think when I saw how much we were paying every month in our first mortgage and I saw that money automatically leave our account every month, I started fantasizing what it would be nice to actually have that cash not leave.
Yeah.
Right. And so just so you start getting these ideas and with this money, we could take a trip every month or whatever. Right. You get it into these little sort of fantasies in your head. And so that kind of got me thinking, let's figure out how we can pay this thing off as quickly as possible.
How has your spending changed now that you don't have the mortgage elimination goal? Mm-hmm. Did you really have to double down on discipline? Because the goal would be a little bit more ephemeral, I think, as you think about investing for the future. It's not it's not quite the same enemy as paying off the mortgage.
Right. So it's interesting because when we first at first, the motivation was let's get rid of the mortgage because we want that money. But then we got used to this lifestyle of not spending all that money every month. And so once the mortgage was paid off, I realized, we're actually really behind on retirement savings because we've been pumping everything into the mortgage. And so instead of spending all that money like I initially fantasized about, it now became, let's quickly save for retirement. And so we applied that exact same level of discipline to investing for retirement. And we actually became financially independent when I was 32. So that we kind of, hit that sort of milestone where theoretically we could live off the investments if we wanted to.
The people who will roll their eyes at your behavior and your accomplishment are those who can't reconcile the notion of being so aggressive about a financial goal and living a full life. What would you say to them?
I would say there's a lot of things that we think are musts in terms of spending, but they're really not. And then we kind of get tricked into this thinking that if we just spend money, it's going to make us happy. That spending, if we spend an extra $10,000 on some shiny object that's going to make us happier, but it actually doesn't. And so I found once, even though we were making these sacrifices and only living off one income, I found our happiness was still great. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, a lot of times people think, well, we have to have these expenses, but we really don't. So for example, you know, they think they have to have this expensive house. They think they have to have two cars or, you know, things of that nature. But there's really a lot of fat that can be trimmed as soon as you disassociate the spending money with happiness piece.
You don't live in a big city. You live close to a big city, but you don't live in a big city. Do you think that's an advantage culturally in that you don't have the temptation around, you don't have the people who are, you know, to live in any neighborhood in a major city, you're spending $1 million. There's just no way around it.
I could see that. I mean, if you're in Toronto, you're tempted
lesser extent.
For sure. I mean, I'm in Kitchener, right? So sure, we have some nice concerts here and there, but I mean, nothing compared to Toronto or going to Broadway or something like that, right? So I would say, yeah, there probably are a lot more temptations in Toronto. But you know what? Now with online shopping and things like that, I mean, it's so easy to spend money.
To overspend, no matter, equal opportunity overspending, where you live.
So I don't think we can really use that as kind of an excuse, right? It's all about, I think, what your goals are and how badly do you want them, and do you want to hit them faster, or are you okay hitting them slower but spending a little bit more?
Cornell, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me on.
Cornell Schreiber is the creator of Build Wealth Canada. We're calling it one of our blogs to watch. Time now for How I Do It. So this is our series of questions that we pose to one of our guests about how they manage their very own personal finances. Because we talk so much about how people should do it, I want to talk about how people actually do it. Our guest today, Laura McKay, co-founder of Policy Me. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You go to buy coffee at a coffee shop. Do you pay with cash, debit, or credit, and why? Don't tell me you don't drink coffee. Do you drink coffee?
I do drink coffee.
Good, I was going to say.
I get pulled into Starbucks loyalty program.
So do you have a Starbucks card?
I have a Starbucks app, I always pay by app.
So if you're on a corner at a corner and there's a Starbucks and another coffee shop, you're going to Starbucks because you got their app.
Because of the loyalty points.
Okay, yeah, and what is the average price of your order at Starbucks?
$2.26. I know
you
that.
Buy a wow, is that like a black coffee?
Yeah.
Tall black coffee.
Yeah.
Mine too. You're never tempted by the Fufilala Venticino?
No.
Oh my God. Why do you think that is? Oh, it's too much milk?
Yeah.
I do it because I'm too cheap.
Yeah. I'm pretty cheap about it too. I drink so much coffee that if I were to buy like a $6 coffee every day, I think that would be out of control.
No mortgage money.
Yeah.
What about your life, financial life, is automated? What have you automated about your financial life?
Interesting.
Bills, retirement savings, or do you do that ad hoc?
I definitely, my bills are completely automated. I find out how automated when I switch a credit card and all of a sudden everything breaks
down.
And I'm like, I need to switch 17 subscriptions to a different credit card. I would say budgeting is pretty automated. I use like Mint in order to just track that. That's it.
With retirement savings, is it a pre-authorized amount that transfers out?
No, if I'm being perfectly honest,
I
a lot of my money is sitting in a checking account.
Right.
It's
okay,
really,
you've got some homework.
It's not great.
It's good.
I know.
What changed when you went from being a business person and with expense accounts and all that stuff to being an entrepreneur? What changed for you?
Yeah, I would say the biggest change was not taking an income.
Right.
Which is my current situation. I gave myself kind of 2 years to really do this lean and not take an income at the beginning. So that's where I am right now. So living off of savings, as well as I have a partner. My husband obviously supports, kind of his income supports our household.
We've got some snacks in the green room. So you can take some of those and call it dinner. It'll be fine.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is just, saving. Savings took a little bit of a halt before I had employer contributions, and then I also did my own individual contributions through my employer plan. But at this point, I'm not doing that.
What are you nuts about when it comes to money? And what are you que sera sera about when it comes to money?
In terms of kind
so
of being
I am
frugal?
One person. Yeah, like yeah. I am the worst about insurance. I have it.
Yeah.
But it's not like I became a temporary expert. Life's easier because you buy it for 10 years and forget it.
Yeah.
But like home and property, I have no interest in that whatsoever.
Yeah.
Whereas I am nuts about the value I get from a grocery store. I am an extraordinary shopper at a grocery
Interesting.
Store.
Interesting.
Oh, yeah.
What I am very lax about, I would say, is, yeah, personal errands. Like, I go to Shoppers all the time, and I feel like I'm just dropping, like, $50.
And you are.
Leads
to Shoppers and not Costco.
I think I should definitely be optimizing that spending
right.
a little bit better, especially,
right.
like, you know, just buying when things are on sale. I'm very much impulse. Like, if I need it, I'm just going to buy it now. I don't
right.
really think about those things ahead of time to stock up. I would say real estate I'm obsessed with lately because we're kind of in a position. We've been renting now for many, many years. We're kind of in entering our 30s and starting to think about buying
yeah.
a property. And that's just like, I love realtor.ca or whatever.
It's the best. I had to take it off my phone.
Yeah.
I have to manage my participation in open houses because I could spend every weekend going to open
yeah,
houses. And
so,
we already own.
Yeah.
No point. We already own.
Yeah. So I just obsessed with just like looking at little tiny price variations and different neighborhoods and stuff like that.
You and your husband, what are the things that you're on the same page about money? And what are the things where you're like, I don't know if that's the way we should do
yeah.
that? Or are you like 100%
I would say,
rainbows and unicorns all the time?
Food. I love food. I love cooking. So I am a splurger on food.
Yes.
Whereas he could eat like canned pasta sauce
uh-huh.
and pasta every night of the week and like
and
never be bothered.
Right.
Whereas I'm like, I want to
I found
make
this
the
new
like
restaurant.
Truffle risotto and I'm spending like $10 on these mushrooms.
Right.
You know, like I think I am very much, I'm willing to spend a lot more on food than
right.
he would be. In terms of the same page, I would say big purchases for us. We're not impulse like new TV buyers or
right.
couch purchasers. Like we're pretty minimalist when it comes to stuff.
Right.
Like we don't like accumulating furniture or anything like that or switching over furniture all
right.
the time. So we're pretty much on
okay,
the same
one last question. Who files your tax returns?
My dad's an accountant, so I've like
what?
Never had to think about
You've
that.
You've never had to do it, and he does it.
I honestly know so little about
so
it, just because I just
never
yeah have used
to.
That forever.
Laura, thank you for
yeah.
your honesty. Thanks for your insight. We appreciate
yeah.
it.
Thanks,
Laura McKay, co-founder of Policy Me. That is our show for today. Don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter. Just go to moolala.ca, scroll down a little bit, and subscribe to the newsletter. You can even subscribe to the podcast, too. That'd be fun. Here's how we can stay connected. You could follow me on Twitter, at Bruce Celery. Facebook is Bruce Celery Moolala. Or email ask@moolala.ca. Thank you very much for joining us, and have a great day.